a book review. The name of the book, Newman 101, An Introduction to the Life and Philosophy of John Cardinal Newman. The table of contents for this book read as follows and give us an idea of what this book will be treating. Chapter 1, Have You Read Any Newman? Question mark. 2, Newman's Path. 3, A Mind Alive. 4, Infallible Authority. 5, Mary, the Mother of Jesus. 6, Serving the Laity. 7, Seeking Church Unity. 8, Strange Providence. 9, Preaching a Living Faith. 10, Witness to Holiness. And chapter 11, The Flame of Love. And now we turn to the preface to get an idea of what this book contains in its content. The preface starts, when people are beatified or canonized, they are being offered to us as examples of holiness that we can follow with confidence. We need not suppose, however, that they have always been perfect. John Henry Newman once said as much about one of his theological heroes, St. Cyril of Alexandria, who, as a churchman, could be a ruthless political operator. We are not obliged, Newman remarked, to defend aspects of his ecclesial career. It does not answer to call Whitey Brown white. Much more recently, Pope Benedict XVI echoed the same view. In his Wednesday audience on January 31, 2007, he observed, "The saints have not fallen from heaven. They are people like us who also have complicated problems. Holiness does not consist in never having erred or sinned." These are comforting words. Newman himself has been a significant influence in my life. He may soon be beatified. In any case, my debt to him is far-reaching. In this book, however, I am not suggesting that he was always right about everything. I do not feel obliged to champion and defend every position he took. Holiness does not consist in never having erred or sinned. All the same, as his cause for beatification makes plain, he has a great deal to offer us. It will be obvious, therefore, that this book does not pretend to be exhaustive, resolving disputes of scholarly detail between Newman's specialists. Newman wrote so much that he created a rich arena for debate. Those controversies may have something to teach us, but they are not my concern here. I plan rather to offer access to his life and thought and experience by avoiding unnecessary detail. I shall draw attention instead to some of the elements that have impressed me and that may therefore be valuable to others. I will start with those points that made an impact on me, even from the beginning. Then I will sketch his life and consider more especially his search for the church. That search itself was lifelong. Next, we need to be aware of the thinking that underpinned his thought. This chapter is entitled A Mind Alive. It is central, but not because Newman can be reduced to an icy intellectual. His mind was alive because it reached out to touch the heart and engage the whole person. That union of mind and heart and person will be evident time and again in what follows. Then his interpretation of papal infallibility, the way he presented teaching about Mary both as an Anglican and as a Catholic, and the value he placed on the role of the laity in the church are all issues that can be seen as controversial. But the way Newman treated them points as well to his care for ecumenism, his sensitivity to the need for the church to be one. After probing these issues, we can return to the man himself, his awareness of divine providence, his preaching about faith, and his life as a witness to holiness. And at the end, as a kind of coda, there is a reflection on his poem, The Dream of Gerontius. And now we move to a section in the book to get an idea of what this chapter on A Mind of the Alive contains. It begins, "However difficult it may be to chart the course of Newman's long and involved life, it is still more demanding to capture the character of his mind. One reason for that is something personal, something about him. It was identified neatly by Catholic theologian Nicholas Lash when he drew attention to that very closeness of speech to the speaker, of text to thinker, which is the hallmark of his genius. Sometimes people have written about Newman's theological method and even done it rather well. Nevertheless, the theories they parade can seem stiff and alien because, as Lash explains, it is Newman who makes the difference to those touched by his spell, far more than his arguments or ideas considered in abstraction. While mapping the mind, we must never forget the man. The man was always more interested in reality than theory. He was concerned with what actually happened. His sympathies lay instinctively with a process of reasoning that was direct and immediate. So, in 1870, in his Grammar of Assent, he declared, "I say then that our most natural mode of reasoning is not from propositions to propositions, but from things to things, from concrete to concrete, from holes to holes." That was his style, and we notice at once the way this approach is naturally in tune with the priority he gave to pastoral care throughout his life. Besides that, when reading Newman, we may also become aware of certain preoccupations that appear time after time. There are themes that give unity to his life and way of thinking. First, there was his devotion to the cause of revealed religion. Toward the end of his life, he stated, "Revelation is the initial and essential idea of Christianity." Stephen Dessaine believed that this cause was the fundamental interest of his life. Next, there was his search for the church, which we have considered already. What has been revealed, be it ever so pregnant with meaning, is void unless received. Faith receives the revelation, but faith is never disembodied. To be more precise, it is the church, as the community of faith, that receives and seeks to live the revelation. Church and revelation are inseparably linked. Revelation, of course, is made known in particularly privileged way through Scripture. But it is found there, as Newman used to say, unsystematically. Consequently, later, after the pressure of controversy, what has been received through Scripture needs to be given sharper focus. And so his third preoccupation was with dogma, the interpreting and distilling of what has been revealed. From the age of 15, he remarked, "Dogma has been the fundamental principle of my religion." And what has been revealed and received by the church and articulated as dogma is meant also to be communicated. And so, the fourth key preoccupation of Newman's life was with education. The need to provide people with a deeper understanding of their faith so that they might be better able to give an account of it. In his journal, in January 1863, when at a low point in his life he recorded, "From first to last, education, in this large sense of the word, has been my line." To note these four themes, revelation, the church, dogma, and education, as well as the relationship among them, should not, however, mislead anyone into shaping a theory of Newman's thought in their terms. They are noteworthy simply because they recur in his writings like refrains. Nevertheless, the question remains, how can we capture the character of Newman's mind, the tenor of his thinking? How is it best to proceed? One occasion that happened late in his life may be a good place to start. And with this, I end our book review. I believe that today, being in the age of the laity, promoting ecumenism, and trying to really define the church in modern times, we should be really looking at Newman. He was ahead of his times. If there was anyone who knew how to think this through and put it together, it was he. And we should also look at his personal life. He was a very, very spiritual man who knew fasting, who knew how to be selfless, and was just a beautiful person to watch in this life in which we have so much, and yet we do not know how to deal with it. Here was a man who knew how to deal with it through his own spiritual life. End of book review.